Welcome to the Berean class. We're studying the book of Ephesians, and we're stuck in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. Parents often talk about the younger generation as if they didn't have anything to do with it. And every generation complains about the generation that's following them. My grandparents were concerned about their children. Our parents were concerned about us. We're concerned about our children. And I suspect our children will be scared to death about the world that their children enter. Laura Schlesinger, who had a terrible relationship with her own mother, even as an adult, she spent a lot of her time trying to reconcile that relationship, had this, I think, helpful insight. Children are our second chance to have a great parent-child relationship. That is profound. Unfortunately, many of us do not learn from our experience or from our observations and repeat them over and over again. This is why, in many respects, the family in our culture remains in a stressful situation. Generation from generation, we don't seem to learn some basic things. But after this class is over, you will know everything. Not really. When it's over, it'll never be over. Everything I've learned about parenting, I've learned from watching my parents, from being a parent, watching my children, and watching hundreds of other families deal with children. And that is more important than all the books that I've read on the subject and things I've heard other people say. I am not an expert, but I've learned a lot in my 74 years by reflecting upon the home I grew up in and by, more than anything else, watching my children parent their kids. I think the real test of parenting is to see how your kids parent their children. And there are a lot of things I would have loved to have done over with our children. The one thing that when people ask me, what did you learn about parenting your children? I say, the one positive thing I learned is that we didn't spoil them or we didn't overmanage them. We gave them freedom. And that's a risk. In our case, it turned out quite well. But that is not always what's called for. Anyway, we'll talk about some of that stuff. Here's the passage again. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Last week we talked about the fact that a healthy marriage is where parenting starts. It's the context out of which most parenting should and does take place. Father's presence and headship is an important factor in child development. In an egalitarian society where we are led to believe that it makes little difference whether the father is there or not, sociologists would tell us quite different story than that. When the father is absent, either emotionally or physically, it has a huge impact on the whole family, and especially children. The first rule is this in child development: don't abuse children. Notice the first thing Paul says in this passage to parents, to fathers, and fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. He doesn't say, first thing, be sure you give a catechism education to your children. Be sure you help them memorize Torah. Be sure you help them learn the Ten Commandments. He doesn't say that. The first thing he says to them is don't abuse them. Don't provoke them to anger. Provoke to anger is a word that can be translated and is translated in other places with keep needling, That's my paraphrase. Or to taunt. That is, to basically not think about the consequences of what you're saying to your children, but just reflect your own emotions to them. That is the kind of thing that oftentimes can be and is abusive. Discipline. Correct the transition, the transgressions. The discipline here has to do with when someone's coloring outside the lines or straying from the fold, getting them back. And instruction. Instruction here, the word is not didache, or the common word for teach. It's not lecture. It's not a catechism. But words of encouragement and or admonition. Being a life coach on the run, that is being there when children go through big good times and bad times. Someone has said that it's quality time, not the amount of time a parent spends with a child, that makes a difference. Quality time is very important, but the kind of quality time that's needed only comes by being there all the time, or at least a lot of the time, so you know when the quality time is going to work, when the child basically feels alone, when the child is tempted to basically take advantage of those around them and not give consideration to the broader context of their life. You don't have those quality moments if you don't have time with kids. Parents are the first and most powerful mentors for emerging human beings. You just think about it. Of course, that's true. We live in a culture where oftentimes children have one parent, or sometimes have no parent, or step-parents, or grandparents. And this is why, although most of us have are past childbearing or have never been married or have children, all of us bear some responsibility in terms of the culture where children are growing up. And that's why I don't apologize for basically having a class dealing with parenting with people who basically have no opportunity to directly do that or are no longer doing that. I'm going to argue that you still play a role in terms of how you think of children, how you help those around you with children, how you relate to children. Physical and emotional neglect is the most common form of child abuse. Neglect. Neglect. It's not what you do, it's what you don't do oftentimes that's abusive in terms of a child's life. Healthy bonding with parents is the key to nurturing children to maturity. Bonding, basically what I mean by that is this: caring without overly controlling. Empathizing without excusing. Protecting without being a surrogate. Affirming without inflating. And consistency without rigidity. That's what bonding means. It's hard to identify precisely what bonding is all about, but some signs that bonding has taken place. When a parent is separated from a child for a period of time and the parent comes back, does the child get excited about seeing the parent or not? A proper, healthy bonding relationship will usually be seen in the way in which the child responds when the parent returns. One of the things that I'm going to use a positive and a negative example. The negative example has to do with my parenting. I took a sabbatical once several years ago, went to Vancouver, Cece and I did, to Regent College. I grew a beard, and I came back home. We left our children with my parents. We walked in. They were scared to death of seeing. They didn't recognize me. They were afraid. Now, that is not the kind of response that I think is healthy. I watch my grandchildren when we care for them, when Debbie, our daughter, and her husband, Naushi, are away. They can be away for a night out, and we're fortunate. The kids like to stay with us. We like to stay with them. The parents get a break. It happens often. whenever they come back, I say, Mommy and Daddy are here, they jump up and run to the door and give them a hug. It's not discipline, it's just a response. And I say to myself, that's bonding. Bonding has taken place there. I don't know how they did it or what makes it work. Well, I do by watching them. But that's what you look for. This is what happens when bonding doesn't take place. I'm not going to go through all of this, but researchers have studied bonding with between parents and children and noticed that when proper bonding does not take place, there are two things that are very different but come from the same source. Chasing after and withdrawing from relationships, the bullies and the bulliers, both of them tend to come from families where bonding has not been effective, and there's no way to determine whether you produce a bully or a bullier. But if bonding takes place in a proper, healthy way, if there's a connection between parents and children where they feel secure in significance and significant because of that relationship, they are going to tend to be immune to being bullied or to being the bullier. Bad things happen when that bonding does not work. Child abuse then and now. In Paul's day, patria potestas. That was the father's absolute power in ancient Rome to keep and throw away his children. If in Roman society, before Paul's day and to some extent in Paul's day, if I was a man and I had a daughter and I wanted a son, I could kill the daughter. I could throw the daughter away, literally throw the daughter in the trash. They were property to the father. Now, it's hard for us to imagine that. Charles was saying that one of the characteristics of a mother is nurturing. For the first years, that's very true. In traditional societies, the father did most of the nurturing after that. As children approached adolescence, the father had a huge role in nurturing children. This is why, for example, in this passage, Paul is addressing not mothers. He doesn't address mothers at all. It's fathers. Because until the Industrial Revolution, fathers were in the home with the children all the time. After the Industrial Revolution, when fathers went off to the factory, mothers were left to do all the parenting. But that's something that's unique to our culture and our age. It was not traditionally that way. Now, again, there are lots of exceptions to that. But the point is, we tend to assume that the world always was the way we have experienced it. A lot of things have changed because of the revolutions that have taken place. Judeo-Christian ethics and principles have had a large role in shaping our modern conscience respecting the respect of children. The way children are treated today, even in a pluralistic pagan culture, is positive because of the influence of Judeo-Christian values. I mentioned Bart Ehrman's book, How Christianity Conquered the Roman Empire. In the introduction to the book, he talks about a number of ways in which our culture today is indebted to Christianity in ways in which we would never imagine. And one of the things he mentions is the way in which we treat children. This is something that many people don't recognize. It traces itself back to the Judeo-Christian influence in our culture. Delinquent parents that are insensitive, verbally rejecting, neglect, physical abuse, tend to form delinquent kids. 30% of abused and neglected children grow up to be abusers, as compared to 5% who grew up in healthy families. That's significant. The U.S. has had no child abuse laws until the 1960s. We think that it was always you could prosecute parents for delinquency. Until the 1960s, you couldn't do that, early 1960s, 1962, 61. Nearly 1 million children are abused in the U.S. annually. And most of that abuse isn't by neglect. Child Protective Services protects more than 3 million children annually in our culture. Neglect is the most common form of maltreatment, and most of it comes from mothers, not fathers, surprisingly. Because oftentimes it's a single mom, a mom without a father and a husband, who's caring for children while holding down two jobs. That's a tragic reality of a lot of the dark side of our culture. Frederick Douglass, a powerful quote: "It is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." I mentioned last week that in premarital counseling, I tell people that the most important characteristic in terms of having a couple, a mate, a marriage, that is going to be successful in the sense that it's going to provide a happy, nurturing, and mutually satisfying relationship is not, are you Christian? Now that sounds heretical, because I think it's clear in Scripture we are to marry within our faith. But the most important characteristic has to do with the health of the person you're marrying and your health. And I'll tell you why. A person can become a Christian in an instant. A person who has a flawed character and has been abused early in life, it'll take years to overcome that, if at all. And unless you're prepared to live with that, buckle your seatbelt, because that won't go away easily. Many of you know that from personal experience. Those experiences will not go away. I remember counseling a young couple several years ago who were getting married, and I was very concerned about the relationship. The young woman had a long history of emotional struggles and pretty severe psychological trauma. And I asked her why she wanted to marry this young man, which is a question I ask all couples. Tell me, talk about why you're marrying this person. She said, because I believe it'll make me better. And I turned to her fiancé and I said, did you hear her? You're going to become her doctor. Are you up for that? Or her Messiah? She's hoping, nothing else has worked. She's hoping you will work. And I said, I want to talk to you alone. So the next time we met, I talked with him alone. And I said, tell me what you heard her say. And he repeated it. I said, I think you understand what she's saying. Are you prepared to carry that load? And he said, yes, I am. I said, okay. My role as a counselor is not to tell you who to marry and who not to marry. My role is to help you be realistic in terms of what you're facing and who you are. And he indicated to me he was. Several years later, I don't know how many, maybe a year, 2 years, it was some time later, I was hiking in Umstead Park, and I ran into both of them. They were hiking too. And I said, we greeted, had small talk, and I said, tell me, how are things going? He said, great. I said, wow. I was so thrilled. I don't know any of the details, but the fact that they were still together, I thought, was great. And one thing I've learned about marriage counseling, I've been a very poor predictor about what marriages succeed and which ones fail. There are some marriages that I performed that I thought were golden, and they turned out to be very, very damaging. Others that I thought would never work, and they worked. So I've just kept my mouth shut and say, you know, there's a lot of this stuff I don't understand, can't control. But the point is, it's a lot easier to prepare someone for marriage than to repair a person after they're in midlife. Second rule of child development, don't let the child control the process. The first is, don't abuse. Second, let the child control the process. Train up a child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. Every Sunday school class has you memorize that verse someplace along the line or hear it. Here is part of the problem with this verse. It is not nearly as clear as most translations have it. Train here means to prop up, like you prop up a plant, or the scaffolding on a building, the boundaries that determine the limits of the walls and the ceiling. But literally, the way he should go in Hebrew reads according to his way. And it could be interpreted this way. If you train up your child in the way he wants to go, when he's old, guess what? You're going to have a brat. If you train up a child in the way he should go, then when he's old, he will have a long, profitable life. He'll make contributions, or he or she. But many translators, or many Hebrew scholars, will say the real sense here could be, and probably is, if you let a child have his way or control the process of growing up, has no boundaries, no sense of discipline, no sense of authority, don't be surprised when they're old, they're trapped by their upbringing, by the training that they brought upon themselves. You need parents. Two big mistakes in terms of child rearing I've observed. One, children are monsters. What they need is strict discipline right after birth. Start beating the sin out of them. The sin nature, they're little devils. And you've got to basically just discipline them to death to get rid of that sin nature. Now, there's some parents that have basically had that idea, spare the rod and spoil the child. They're not going to spare the rod and spoil their child starting right from birth. Be careful. Mistake number two, children are innocent. Minimal control is best. Just let them find their way. The only thing that corrupts children is the environment created by adults. So if you can keep adult standards and adult rules and adult fears and anxieties out of their life, they'll grow up and be perfectly happy jewels, examples of security and significance. Both of these have big problems. In reality, children are a part of a fallen world with the rest of us. They have selfish impulses that need to be managed in the context of the gospel. What I mean is this. Sin or selfishness is not a learned behavior. It's something that we have by birth. And it's not just a self-defense mechanism. It's just basically sin. Little kids aren't just trying to defend themselves. They are mean, or they can be mean. Sin can be managed, but not removed. And sin leads to respect for the gospel message. We would not come to Christ if we did not have a sense of conscience in terms of what is expected of us and where we fall short. That is something that's good. Parents need to be aware of that to help children learn from sin, learn from their selfishness, learn from their foolishness. It is not stopping it out of them. It's basically help them learn through it or by it. Parents are to help a child develop a conscience, wisdom, and godly character, and to give them a break. Some parents think they can basically make their children perfect. Big mistake. you can be assured that you can do great damage to your children if you expect too much from them. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't expect a lot from them, but be patient in the process. After all, think about your growing up. Now, I know some of you were perfect children growing up, but you have a bad memory. Dr. Phil's comment, I quote him all the time. Doesn't mean I always agree with him, but when I do, I quote him. Always try to avoid conflict with your children, but if there is conflict, never let them win. I'll tell you why he says that. When a child knows that they can control you, you've lost your parenting leverage. Even if you're wrong. Now, this changes as a child gets older. The older a child gets, the more control they need to have. You have to rely on influence as they get older. But when they're young, it's important. The most important thing, as we're going to see in a minute, is they learn to respect authority. It'll save their life in more ways than one. But what he's saying here to parents who basically are, and he's counseling out-of-control parents with out-of-control children, he says, when you get in a fight with your kids, try to avoid it, but if you get in a fight with your kids, never let them win. He's talking about younger kids and rebellious teenagers as well. When you do that, you lose your leverage to help them.
They also feel unsafe.
I'm sorry?
I think they also feel unsafe.
Right. There are no boundaries. Yeah. They're basically in control. They feel as though they're in control. Most children do not want to be. They tell you they want to be in control, but they don't mean that. I got a kick out of Casey. I think I maybe told you this before. I can't remember. One of the youngest twins of our daughter, Debbie, they spent overnight with us a couple of weeks ago. And Debbie called me the next morning, and she said, guess what Casey said to me last night? She said, Mama, Grandpa's a lot more fun than you are. Now, Debbie thought that was funny. I thought it was great.
Maybe Graham was too lenient with her.
I'll tell you what happened. There was a video game they wanted to watch, and they got me to download it. And I learned out later it was one that the parents said they aren't to watch. But they ganged up. You know, I said to Alex and Sasha, the older children, are you supposed to watch this?
That's a lesson for grandparents.
That it is.
The philosophy of grandparents say, well, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to spoil them as much as I want, and the parents will have to deal with it. You know?
Some studies have indicated that the strongest influence on teenagers are their peers. Number two, grandparents. Number three, parents. And when you think about it for a moment, in a good family relationship, parents project respect for their parents. Kids sense that. So grandparents are a little closer to God in the pecking order than parents are. Although children have a remarkable sense very early of the existence of authority, I mean, even divine authority. If we get this far, talk about that in a little bit. He who withholds his rod or spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. He who withholds his rod refuses to discipline or protect them and thus comfort them. The same word here is used in Psalm 23, verse 4. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. The rod is used both to comfort but protect as well, to discipline and to protect. Now, a lot of people have taken this, unfortunately, very literally. They say, biblically speaking, if you're going to raise your kids, you should be spanking them at least. And it should be with a rod. Now, a stick may do it if it's hard enough. But, I mean, give me a break. Where have you had any understanding of the use of language? this kind of language is not meant to be taken in that kind of literal sense. It's an expression which means if you neglect discipline, if you don't put boundaries on children, they're going to suffer, and eventually you will too. But discipline them diligently. Protect them from themselves and from the world around them.
Well, Jim, sometimes discipline involves allowing them to suffer the consequences of their
Certainly.
Deeds if the consequences aren't going to be harmful to them.
I'm getting to that, Charles. That is an excellent point. That is an excellent point. And if I don't get there, I'm glad you made it. Be consistent and persistent. That's what I take from this verse is primarily this. For parenting, be consistent and be persistent. Don't let them win. Don't let them control the process. But be consistent. One of the many things I've learned by watching Naushi and Debbie handle two sets of little twins is, and I asked Debbie about this, and she said that I was reading too much into it. But I said, it looks as though you have, the two of you have sat down and decided how you're going to do this, and you've done it. But the thing that has impressed me as I've watched them close range is their consistency. Very frankly, I could never remember Debbie or Naushi ever raising their voice at their kids. Never. As a matter of fact, Cece and I got into an argument once when the kids were over there, and we raised our voices. Sasha. The world is coming to an end. She's never heard an authority figure in her life raise their voice. And we asked Sasha, does mommy ever raise her voice? And she said, no. Now, I know Debbie well enough. If she doesn't at them, she does at us. But the point is this. What's impressed me in watching them is the consistency. And they seem to expect the children to go through bouts of tantrums and misbehavior. And it's as though they were prepared for it and they knew exactly how to respond. By being cool, they knew what the procedure was. And in terms of discipline, they weren't blown away by it or acting emotionally or overreacting. Consistent and persistent parenting makes a huge difference.
Didn't Debbie have experience in situations like this? Wasn't she a teacher before she had children?
Yes. Debbie has an unfair advantage in that she's a school teacher. I asked Debbie, I said, what is your strength as a teacher? She said, class discipline. She said, I scare the... out of them for the first 2 weeks, and after that, I have no problem. I watched her teach. I sat in her class one day just to see what was going on. I was very impressed with not just the discipline, but the way she handled kids. And that, this is an aside. Growing up, Debbie had no interest in kids. She didn't like to babysit. She told us, she said, if I ever have kids, and if we ever fly, I'm loading them up with Valium before I put them on the plane. I mean, she did not have any empathy for children. As soon as she became a mother, all that changed dramatically, which is wonderful. In Colossians, the parallel passage to this passage in Ephesians, Paul does not mention the need of instruction, but only forbids abuse. He summarizes everything that Ephesians says with these words, Fathers, do not exasperate your children, that they may not lose heart. He doesn't say, but instruct them in the ways of the Lord, starting with Torah and going through the prophets and memorizing the Ten Commandments, so forth and so on. He doesn't say anything about that. He just says, don't abuse them. Don't exasperate, provoke, or stir up, that they might lose heart, be discouraged, or crush their spirit. From childhood to adulthood, there are stages a person goes through. This is my stuff here, my words, but it follows a pattern of things I've observed and have learned. One, security. The first need a child has is to feel secure. It starts before they're born. The sense of lack of trauma in the womb is hard to measure, but it's important. The second thing they need to learn is significance. When they are born, they need to learn that when they cry, someone comes. When they're wet, someone changes. When they're hungry, someone feeds them. They control the world. Now, some parents will say, it's very good from birth on to teach them to wait. No. The first thing a parent should teach a child is that they can control the universe. If they don't feel significant, if they don't get that lesson, everything else is not going to work. It's not going to fall in place. But when they hit about two, they need to recognize there are other people on the planet, not just them. I can remember our son's son, Holt. His first birthday party, he went to one of his friends. He threw a fit. Why? Because he didn't get the presents. He had to learn it was somebody else's birthday. And he thought birthday parties were always for him. A learning moment. The terrible twos, threes, and fours, just be careful that you manage them correctly or you'll have the terrible 15s, 16s, and 17s. And you don't want that. But the significance needs to be then disciplined or put boundaries on because you have other people. It's important to wait. I can remember when Holt was here the last time they visited us, and he threw a tantrum at the table. He wanted dessert before his meal, and he started screaming and hollering, and it really made things very unpleasant for us, like a three-year-old does. And got up and left the table. I talked to Holt later. I sat him down and said, Holt, I put him on my lap. I said, did you really want to have dessert? He said, yeah, it's not fair. I hate you. kind of thing. Four-year-old talk. I said, Grandpa will tell you how to get dessert. To get dessert, you've got to be patient. Do you know what patience means? Patience means that you wait. Now, when you wait, and if you're polite, then you'll probably get dessert. But you've got to wait for other people to finish their meal first. Do you understand what that means? So I went through it again. He finally understood it. I said, I'll tell you what, Holt. Will you let me help you learn how to wait? He said, do you want to grow up to be a big boy that learns how to wait? I said, okay, we got a deal. That day, on three different occasions, when he was throwing a tantrum, I said, Holt, what do you do? And he said, be patient. I was shocked. But the point is, he was learning. He was actually listening and learning something in the process. Now, did that stick? I don't think so. But it was a first step. The point is, at a certain point, parents need to really, with gentleness, help a person recognize that they're not the only person in the world. And if they want to, we're going to see in a minute, if they want to be a blessing to others and to be blessed, they've got to learn to participate with others. The third thing, or fourth thing, is skills. This comes at about age 5. You learn how to write. You learn how to read. You learn how to do a lot of things that come with more sophisticated interaction with other people. And then finally, support. At about 18, children should be ready to leave home. One of the things that pleased us and was heartbreaking for us is that when our kids left high school, they were ready to leave home. We weren't ready for them to leave home in some respects. We hated to see them be so independent. But it didn't take us long to recognize we're so thankful they were able to do that. Control for a parent is really important in the first years, but it must phase into influence as time goes on. When you get to 18 and you're still trying to control them, you have lost it. It's too late. Now you pray and you influence by example. And it's long before 18. If you're fortunate and blessed, by 18, kids are, they need support, but they're ready to make good decisions. Not all good decisions, but make generally good decisions and learn from them. Four types of parents. The bodyguards keep kids away from the water and the world. The lifeguards rescue those who fall in. Swimming instructors jump in and teach them to swim. And the spectators let them go their own way. Parenting is appropriate in each of these, or each of these represent a certain aspect of parenting that's appropriate. The problem comes when you have bodyguards and lifeguards that should be swimming instructors. Many kids are afraid to develop a child's immune system. Yet 95% of what a child learns is through their own experience. Building up the body's immune system is very important. I grew up on a farm. A farm is a bacteria factory. Be thankful that's mud. I'm amazed as I think back. How did we survive on a farm where we took a bath once a week, whether we needed it or not, washed our hands once in a while before we ate, and we lived with bacteria? We got an immune system that's worked overtime. The same is true culturally. Our ability to manage social differences come from exposure with a swimming instructor. People who help the children accommodate the bully or being bullied. Children that have a life coach early on in terms of people who don't share their faith or don't share their values. Learning that early. Now, I'm not saying too early, but I said that at a certain point, and parents will disagree as to when the bodyguard and the lifeguard starts to depart and the swimming instructor begins. But I would suggest as early as you can make that shift. And then when they get to be older, you can relax and be a prayer and a spectator. But don't be a spectator at the beginning and don't be at the beginning and let them go their own way. But at the same time, don't be a lifeguard or a bodyguard all the way through until they're supposedly adult. They'll never be an adult. Four rules of child development. Respect for authority. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. This is the way the passage starts. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Notice here again the first point, obedience. He doesn't say when the parents are right. He says the first point is learn to obey. I don't care how wrong they are, with exceptions certainly, but obey them. The issue, the principle, is authority, respecting authority, both divine and human, and blessings that follow. I remember Debbie not wanting to go to music lessons. Mary Frances Boyce, I think, was her teacher, maybe Mary Fran. Nancy. Nancy's not here this morning, so I can talk about it. Debbie did not want to go. She was probably 4 years old, four or five, to lessons. I was studying this passage for a sermon. This is 1988 or someplace. And my desk was at home in our bedroom. That's where our office was. And I was frustrated. I said, Debbie, you've got to go to class. It's 10 minutes. You're going to be late. And I was flabbergasted. And I looked down at this passage, and I said, okay, this is, you know, kind of my frustration. Took Debbie up in my lap, and I said, Debbie, what does this say? She says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. I said, what does that mean? means I go to violin lessons. And she went. So the point is this. Kids have an instinct for authority if it's pricked properly. But if the authority basically is abusive and they get by with challenging it successfully, they're going to keep doing that. One of the greatest sources of security for a young child is when you're in social context, when mom or dad says, come here now, that they come there now. When a child runs away from you in traffic, it could kill them. They don't know when you say stop, stop. They need to know if you're going to go into public, when you say stop, they must stop. And they must learn to stop. When we cross the street, we all hold hands. When you don't hold hands, we're not going to cross the street. When you ride your bicycle, you put on a helmet. If you don't want to wear a helmet, it means you don't want to ride a bicycle. And they may not understand why that's significant, but again, obedience here is the issue, the big issue. A child who's allowed to be disrespectful of his parents will not have true respect for anyone. And Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Is that right?
Goethe.
There are only two lasting bequests we can hope to give our children. One of these is roots. The other is wings. Very well said. And all of us have a part, intimately or tangentially to that process. Next week, slaves and masters. You can pray for me on that one.
All right, any comments or questions?